Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Great. Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Riley, Judge Smith, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals by Zoom. Our first case of the morning is file number A21-1245 in the matter of the welfare of the child of OEM. I just wish to remind all parties first that this matter is being recorded. But court rules prohibit anyone from doing their own private recording. So please follow that instructions. And then next, as all parties are aware, counsel for the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Counsel for the respondent will have 15 minutes. And then finally, counsel for the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever counsel for the appellant is ready, you may begin. And please start by introducing yourself in a loud, clear voice. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Michael Schatz, and I am the attorney for appellant, the mother in this matter, OEM. I'll be referring to her as mother most often, as I think it's the clearest. I'll also ask for the court's excuse. I am battling somewhat of a cold, so if I have to cough during the proceeding, I may mute myself just to give you guys a heads up. I'm not trying to be rude.
Thank you.
Your Honors, this matter, often at the Court of Appeals, we see these fancy legal arguments or canons of instructions, things that are very complicated legal matters. I argue this is not one of those. This is a case in which the Court of Appeal, District Court, simply got the findings wrong. The facts from the trial, there's actually two trials in this case, trial number one and trial number two. They were both TPRs. The first one, obviously, as the court's aware, was denied. Then about 9 months later, we had the second trial and findings, which said, yes, there was a TPR. The findings or the facts from the trials simply do not support the findings that the court made. I argue to the Court of Appeals today that those findings are clearly erroneous, and that's the sole basis for my argument to the Court of Appeals asking for either a reversal or a remand for different findings. So in this case—
Mr. Schatz, I don't think motion for a new trial was filed in this case. Is that right? And so my understanding of the law is when no motion for a new trial has been made, the only questions on review are whether the evidence sustains the findings of fact and those findings sustain the conclusions of law and judgment. Do you agree that that's our limited review in this matter?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's exactly what I'm arguing to the court today. I'm not arguing for a reversal of some sort of objection I made or something to that effect. I'm arguing that the facts presented at trial do not sustain the findings that were made.
And you, and in reading your brief, it also looks like you didn't contest the best interest findings. Is that right?
It's not something I contested, Your Honor. I certainly don't concede them, of course, but it's not something I'm asking the court to review at this time.
Thank you.
In fact, I think, and I might be jumping ahead of my argument a little bit, that essentially the district court did a best interest findings only. If looking at the whole of this case, going from trial number one, things were going pretty well. The findings read entirely different from the court based on what I would argue are pretty similar facts compared to trial one and trial two. But then we have this motion to cease reunification efforts, which wasn't even actually a motion. The court did it on its own volition. At that point, the entire case turns. Once the district court said cease reunification efforts because this child is having behavioral issues, at that point, the case was over, Your Honors. So the court then took a best interest analysis and sort of backdoored these statutory criteria. And so if you read the findings, everything is based on what's in the best interest of this child. Does he have these issues? Is he having behavioral issues? And things of that nature. And then they sort of try to fit in these four statutory criteria to say, oh, yeah, these are met too. And I think that's erroneous. I think if you look at the statutory criteria, they do not fit. They do not fit the definitions. So I was going to back up here in just a second and just say this. This is a case, the two trials, it might be the most I've ever seen a parent do in terms of working a case plan. It's one of the most complex and intensive case plans I've ever seen in my years working child protection. I think the judge points out in at the end of trial number one, there was 26 different items for the mother to do before reunification could occur. And frankly, those 26 items came about a month before trial number one. So impossible for her to do, and a very tall order for her to do in any case, no matter how long, but just a huge plethora of items for her to do. But she was doing them. That's where the confusion comes about on my part, is she was doing everything asked of her. She was working night and day at this case plan, doing the therapy, doing the arms worker, doing the parent-child relationship, doing the education, remaining abstinent, you name it. And the judge does point out at the end of trial number one some very insightful findings about this, a couple of them, which I think are important from the November 12th, 2021 findings and order, are things such as, and I'm going to point these out, Your Honors, because they're completely contradicted later in findings number two. Things such as that during visits with the child, the mother had little to no concerning behaviors during supervised visits. That's order number 61. Number 62, that the mother was showing affection towards child one, has been consistent with age-appropriate activities, providing for the child's needs, consistent with diaper changing, on time and engaged. And then at page 23, that her parenting skills are progressing. That's at order N, Pren C. And I bring these up, Renner, because then if you look at the findings for trial number two, it's essentially, there's been no progress. This mother has done nothing. Her parenting skills are not progressing. It's impossible for her to learn parenting conduct that's sustainable over time, which the evidence does not support in the slightest. And it completely contradicts the findings from trial number one.
Mr. Schatz, what was the time frame between the end of trial number one and the beginning of trial number two?
The findings for this came out in October 2021 from trial number one. And that's kind of when all these allegations about this, you know, child behaviors came up, and immediately, basically, things kind of, pardon my language, hit the fan. And then trial number two, I believe, I'm sorry, off the top of my head, was July. I know there's about a 9-month difference between findings. So,
well, I mean, one obviously response to your argument is that things went downhill in that time frame. Why is that incorrect?
It is a possible interpretation, except for when we had the same individuals testify. For example, notably, Daniel Swedberg and Abby Crichton, Elise Baker, they all testified at both trials, and their testimony was largely consistent. More progress is being made. Parenting time is going well. And mind you, these are, except for Elise Baker, the two other people I referenced, these are independent supervisors of the parenting time. They're not pro mom, they're not pro county, they're not pro anybody. They're just there to do their job, but they are trained.
But we have the child's therapist during that time saying that visit should be suspended, as I understand the evidence.
I understand your question, Your Honor. Essentially, that came from the behaviors, again, that there was some regression behavior after visits with the mother. I would note that I don't think anybody would allege that mother was doing something to cause this. It's certainly not intentionally cause these behaviors.
Well, you know, I guess then what do you make of, I'm looking at addendum 73, paragraph 15, in the court's finding. Ms. Carlson testified she observed the child trying to leave the room multiple times. And then at a visit at the visitation, when the child was leaving a visit, he would not give the mother a hug or kiss as requested. The mother told the child, if you don't give me a hug or kiss, I'm just going to leave you. Are you saying that finding is not supported by the evidence? I mean, did she or did she not say that?
By the judge as a credible testimony. However, I would note that the overwhelming testimony from everybody else, including all the other supervisors at that parenting center, said that those type of behaviors did not occur. The child was always excited to see mother, had a hard time leaving mother, was very affectionate with mother. And so the overwhelming evidence.
My point was, the mother say what Ms. Carlson testified, she said, if you don't give me a hug, a kiss, I am going to leave you. Are you dispute that actual finding?
I'd have to go back and look at the transcript, but my recollection is that the mother did not agree that that happened.
Okay. But obviously we defer to the court's credibility findings. I guess, you know, the you know, in all of these cases, there's an issue as in, okay, you can go to all the meetings, you can check all the boxes, but unless you internalize the problems that led to the child protection involvement, you know, that's kind of the big issue. You know, did you get it? You know, my words, not anyone else's. So does the evidence support that apart from whatever meeting she was going to or whatever 12-step program she was involved with, does the evidence support that, you know, at the end of the day, the underlying problems or behavior or mindset of your client did not change? I mean, and if that didn't, then that's a problem for me. So why am I wrong, counsel?
Thank you for that question, Your Honor. I believe the evidence shows that her overall mindset did change. In fact, in the beginning, she admitted, I wasn't a very affectionate parent. I was doing things wrong. And that's a lot of the argument we're hearing is, well, she did all these things that were terrible in the beginning. Okay, yeah, that's why the CHIPS case started. However, her and many of her providers and a large number of providers testified, things changed. I noticed a demonstrable change in her. Her affection for the child changed. Her ability to parenting changed. All of these things changed. And yet, if you read the findings of fact the judge issued, the district court judge, you would think, oh, she hasn't changed a lick. But the trial evidence, the transcript, the testimony does not support those findings. And that's why I'm making this argument here today, Your Honor. One of the things heavily relied on is that, well, she's not able to keep up with the changing parenting skills that you know, from age 4 to age 5 to age 7. She won't be able to keep up with that. There's no evidence of that besides the one Ms. McMahon, who based her entire observations on 2 hours worth of observations, and yet not a single other person who've had hours and hours and hours and hours of supervising these conducts would say is even remotely close to that. So to answer your question, I think, Your Honor, is, yeah, there was a substantial change. The trial testimony shows that. The findings do not show that. And that's why I think the findings are clearly erroneous.
Counsel, may I ask, what does the evidence show, and what were the findings, and what does the evidence show relative to mother's ability to have the child for home visits? I think it would have been the spring of 21, I think, when they were talking about it, or the early part of 2021.
You know, the evidence showed that she overslept, right? And that was a big thing the court relied on. Well, she couldn't even make that first visit, she overslept. And that she said, well, it was exhausting because having a toddler for that amount of time is exhausting. I can attest to that. But overall, it seemed like it went well. There was visiting that occurred even when it was supervised that showed the visits went well. That even I think the guardian ad litem said the visits went well when she supervised them. So there was only one prolonged visit, Your Honor. And that was the one that I just referenced that I think that evidence shows.
Which took place when? When did that one take place?
Right before reunification was ceased, which was March 31st, so in the week or two before that. And reunification was ceased March 31st, and then a TPR petition was filed immediately after that in the middle of April.
And at that point in time, where was mother living, and what was her availability to take care of the child at that point in time?
She had purchased a trailer. That is a disputed fact, as I understand it from the county attorney's brief. She was the owner of the home. It was sort of co-purchased by her boyfriend's dad, who was the financier of it. But she was living in a trailer. It had been approved. It was finally revamped and ready to go. It had been, you know, there was no safety concerns when people visited the home. And she was living there, and I believe still is. It's a long-term placement option for her.
And who is she living with, and what was her availability to be with the child?
She was living with, his name is Dan Miller. It's now her husband, actually. But he's been living there. He was part of trial number one as well.
Her Dan Martin, you mean? Is that?
I'm sorry. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, no problem.
And her availability was, aside from her work schedule, she was available to take care of this child. They were still working that up to go from supervised to unsupervised to longer to a trial home visit, but they never got there. So her availability was limited by what social workers would allow her.
And why didn't they get there? I guess that's what I'm getting to. What's your perspective on why they didn't get there?
My impression is the behavioral issues that the child had after returning from her care, which again, nobody would say she did something, like she wasn't neglecting or abusing or anything like that. It was just simply he'd been out of the home for a long period of time and there was these behavioral issues that he exhibited upon returning from her care. There was a pattern of that that the county alleged.
When I read the order, it also sounds like the judge was concerned about Dan Martin's behaviors and his hostility, and she needed to take care of him, and she thought he was a safe person to watch the child.
The judge was concerned, and Dan Martin had some issues with the social workers and probably didn't handle them the best, but in trial number one, the social workers said that he was essentially harmless, that he was a very good caretaker for the child, that he had previously, before this case began, been a caretaker for the child and things of that nature. So that was a concern. I don't think it was a substantial part of this case, though, if I'm speaking my opinion. I thought I saw another question about the jump in. I didn't want to interrupt.
No, I was just focused on finding 41 on the addendum, page 55, which talked about the potential home visit, and it had other issues in there. Maybe you could, we don't need to, I think you've explained, I think, what your response to that, so.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Melissa Hamel, and I'm an assistant Fillmore County attorney in this matter. I represent the respondent, Fillmore County Social Services. This morning, I would ask that you uphold the decision of the trial court to terminate the parental rights of the mother, because the court did not abuse its discretion when it determined that Fillmore County had proved those four grounds. As the court has already discussed some, there were extensive findings of fact made. Attorney Schatz had pointed to the fact that there were two TPR trials that took place in this matter, and there was extensive testimony and evidence presented to the court. The court, in its order following that second TPR trial, where it did terminate the parental rights, made very extensive findings of fact that were supported by the evidence. I understand Attorney Schatz's main argument is essentially that the findings of fact were not supported by the evidence, and that there was other evidence that was presented, and he would ask that there be different findings would have been made. But the mother's disagreement with the findings of fact doesn't change, I guess, the evidence or the findings that were made and whether or not those findings are supported by the record. And if there was...
Counsel, could you tell us, highlight for us, what is the evidence that supports now the findings on four statutory bases being found versus, I think, the first TPI trial found that three bases which were alleged were not found. What changed between trial one and trial two?
I think there was a number of things between trial one and trial two, but I think one of the biggest things is that, as Attorney Schatz had indicated, that in trial one, and I think it's seen from that order that the judge issued following trial one, is that essentially what the judge was saying is that the mother had started to participate in services, and he was giving her more time to engage in those services and show that she could gain insight from those services. Then when we look at following trial number one and kind of what happened, what we see and what the evidence showed is that there were a lot of changes in terms of mother participating in visits. I think it was in December that there was a significant amount of missed visits. There was a change in the mother's housing stability. There were things that the court had noted in terms of the mother not gaining the insight from the services she was participating in. The court, I think, particularly references some things in terms of she had completed the DBT therapy, which was something that was to teach her emotional regulation and how to handle those kind of things. The trial court specifically makes a finding regarding the behaviors that the court saw during that second TPR trial, where the mother essentially stopped answering questions and stormed out of the courtroom and was slamming doors and things of that nature. Also, in terms of her behaviors towards the social workers and the guardian, in that matter. Also, it talks about the stability of the mother in those changing situations where she was with Mr. Martin at the first TPR trial. You know, she did say that was a long-term thing. She had long-term housing at the home in Peterson. And then that she just shortly after trial, I think within, you know, that same month that the order came out, she had moved in with a new individual whom she may or may not have been in a relationship with, and had kind of that inconsistency in the housing. And then when she did get this new home, is very unclear. And I think Attorney Schatz was right. It was disputed on who owns this home that she was in. There was some testimony regarding Mr. John Martin, which would be her boyfriend's father, owning the home and her paying for it. And that was kind of unclear. But then we saw, you know, Dan Martin come back into the picture. And I think that was a significant concern for the court, was Mr. Martin and his behaviors. And the mother's continually saying that Mr. Martin was a safe caregiver. And she continued to say that even, you know, when there was meetings had to try and plan for if a trial home visit can occur. So I think all of those were things that the court considered and went through a significant amount of, I guess, the order and made findings regarding those things that it saw and the lack of insight that it saw in terms of what the mother was gaining from the programming. I know the mother herself had also testified regarding the parenting education, and that's something that she had been receiving since the child was born, and that, you know, when asked at trial, kind of what things have you learned from parenting education and those kind of things, you know, she couldn't relay anything to the court as to, you know, what she had learned in terms of parenting education.
Ms. Hamill, in finding 28, the district court specifically said or held that the mother testified multiple times she's never had a chemical dependency problem and does not have a chemical dependency problem. Does the evidence in the record support that finding?
The evidence supports that, yep, she did testify that. In terms of whether it supports her contention that she didn't have a chemical dependency finding, I don't think that is supported. She did a chemical dependency evaluation when the case started. And if we look even before that, you know, when the child was born, the child did test positive for alcohol. I believe there was a report that the mother had used alcohol while she was pregnant and the child tested positive for THC at the child's birth. There was a chemical dependency evaluation that was done shortly after this case started. And I believe that's what led to the mother joining that CRAFT program. And then she did end up doing an updated one based on positive UAs. I believe there was a two of them, one for alcohol and one for THC. And then there was further programming that was recommended that the mother engage in. I believe during the first trial, she was still engaged in that chemical dependency programming. Ms. Dualman was her counselor for that. And then, but still maintained that she had never had a chemical dependency problem.
Ms. Hamill, if we were to agree with you that the district court's findings or order should be affirmed, what do you think your strongest basis for the affirmance is?
I believe that the strongest basis would be that that the mother is palpably unfit to be a party to the parent-child relationship because of the consistent pattern of specific conduct before the child or specific conditions relating to the parent-child relationship, rendering her unfit for the reasonably foreseeable future to care appropriately for the ongoing physical, mental, or emotional needs of the child under Minstat 260C 301 subdivision 1 subsection 4. I think there was a lot of information that discussed what the child's needs are. And I would say to touch briefly on Attorney Schatz's argument that really all of this focuses on the child and the best interests of the child. I think that definitely the child's needs are a factor, and that's something that need to be considered. What are the child's needs? You know, the child's therapist testified and provided information. The court made findings about the high emotional needs of the child, and that stems from, I think, a lot of the neglect issues that came and led to the removal of the child, but testified about the high needs of the child and those emotional needs. And then if we look at both Ms. Carlson's parental capacity evaluation and then Ms. McMahon and the attachment assessment she did, you know, really supports those findings that the mother doesn't have the capacity or the ability to meet those needs of the child and provide for those needs. So I think that all that supported. I also think, you know, if we look at what the findings are, and we look at what kind of those patterns of conduct are that the judge made extensive findings and went through, you know, even before the child was removed, the issues that were seen with the mother in terms of the attachment with the child, in terms of, you know, her instability with relationships and housing and expecting the child to just kind of adapt and come along for, you know, those situations. I believe she had testified and the court made a finding regarding her thinking that, you know, the child, if she did move to a different location or if the child moved home, that he would just be able to adapt to that quickly, and not understanding the needs, as Ms. McMahon had said, that, you know, if he were to return home, if he were to change, that, you know, that would be very difficult for him. I think secondary to that, you know, we can look at, you know, the conditions and the safety concerns that the court had discussed that led to the removal and that were concerns at the time of removal. And if we look at what those are, many of those are concerns of the court at the time of the TPR trial. And I had, I guess, touched on some of those already in terms of the mother's attachment to the child and expectations for the child. I will note too, I believe it was Abby Grecian, who was one of the parenting supervisors, had testified at the trial about some of the frustrations she saw from the mother when the child was not kind of conforming or meeting her expectations. And that supports what Ms. McMahon had also observed. So I think that when we look at the judge's order too, he really does make these extensive findings that don't focus on one person's observations or one person's opinions or evaluations, but take, you know, the evidence as a whole and the information that he was provided as a whole, and look at how that all fits together and whether or not, based on that, that the mother would be able to parent the child in a way that can provide for all of his needs, not just, you know, providing him that clothing and shelter, but making sure to meet his emotional needs and his developmental needs and understanding all of those things. So I think that all of the evidence here does support those findings that were made by the court, and that the findings made by the court do support the termination of the appellant's parental rights. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hamill. Mr. Schatz, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honors. I heard the words lack of insight or lack of capacity or ability to parent a number of times in that argument, as well as obviously in the brief, and frankly, from the judge's second findings as well. What I have to say about that is simply that if you review the transcript of the hearings themselves, that there's almost no reference to inability to parent. The people who actually observed the parenting, the people who were hands-on in this case, testified that improvements were made, progress was made, insight was made, ability to adapt was made. There's essentially one person, and that's the McMahon, the evaluator, who says she doesn't have the capacity to keep going with this. She doesn't have the capacity to learn new things. And what's funny about that is at one point she said that, and then 2 minutes later she said, well, it's not my job to make capacity determinations. That's not my role. And I said, you just did that. You just made a capacity determination. That's exactly what you just did. And that determination was relied on heavily in these findings. You can see it in there that several times there's reference to the mother's inability to adapt and move forward with this case because she has this inability to learn new things. The evidence overwhelmingly contradicts that, Your Honors. I don't know how to say it besides the transcript itself, being at the trial happened in one way. In the findings, it's like we were at a different trial. The findings themselves, there's from trial number two at least, don't reflect, I believe, what actually happened at the trial. And that's why I think the findings are clearly erroneous.
I'll just go back to the same question I asked Ms. Hamill. I mean, did she at the second trial acknowledge or did she testify that she does not have a chemical dependency problem? Did she say that?
From my recollection, she said, I don't have a CD problem. However, she went through the process and she completely abstained by the time of the second trial, at least. I think she had one or two slip-ups in the first trial. From you, she graduated from treatment and she did extremely well at that chemical dependency treatment because it was part of her case plan. So she did say, yeah, I'm still going to do it. I did move forward and I took the steps necessary to complete that task.
But I mean, that sort of gets to the point I was trying to make when I was, one of the key points of any chemical dependency program is to acknowledge you have a problem. I mean, you can go to all the meetings, but if you, I guess I would have concerns because if she doesn't believe she has a problem, then the potential for relapse, I think, is quite high. So apart from whether or not she went to all the programs and went to all the meetings, is necessity for the internalization of whatever problems that cause child protection to be involved to begin with. And if she doesn't acknowledge that, I guess I would be inclined to affirm the district court's decision. Now, why am I wrong?
I hate telling judges they're wrong, Your Honor, but I think one
well,
of
you'd
the
be the only person who does, so don't worry about it.
I think chemical dependency use was a very low thing in the totem pole for the county. It was issues of neglect and lack of insight and things at that point in the beginning. This was alcohol use and marijuana use. It's not we're talking about methamphetamine or cocaine or heroin or something. I get what you're saying, Your Honor. But if you're asking me why I think this is not the deal it's made out to be, is because it's alcohol and whatnot, that there's never been a huge, like, she's running rampant, drunk off the streets, that kind of thing. Those weren't the allegations. The evaluation came back that she should do the treatment that she did, and she did it. So whether or not she agreed that she had this substantial problem, it could be very true that she did not have a substantial problem, but she could be right. Even if it did say, well, cut off a use, you're in a child protection program, let's not use it anymore. Okay, she did it. So I think this is sort of the issue of just, I don't say splitting hairs in this case, but whether or not she had a substantial problem is not the issue it's made out to be in this case. The other issues regarding parenting skills, capacity, ability to parent, those are the primary issues. And those parts of the case are what I've been arguing most, that the testimony overwhelmingly supports my claim. if that answered your question.
Yes, thank you. Other questions,
Your Honors, with 8 seconds left?
I don't see any. If you'd like to sum up, we'll give you a little time to do that.
Well, Your Honors, I don't want to ask each one of you to go back and read 15 days worth of, or maybe it was 12 days worth of trial, but I think that if we just read the findings, you're gonna say, Mr. Schatz, you're full of it. You know, your argument lacks merit. But that's the basis of the argument, is that the findings themselves do not support the findings. And I think, just as a kind of a cursory matter, you can review findings number one and findings number two and see that there are substantial contradictions, just simply about the skills being progressed. Oh, there was no progress at all. Oh, she's providing for the needs of the kid. Oh, she's not providing for the needs at all. Though even the findings themselves contradict each other. And that's why that should at least give me a little credibility in terms of the rest of my argument. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Schatz. Thank you, Ms. Hamill. We will be issuing